Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio lawmakers are considering legislation to eliminate civil and criminal statutes of limitations for rape and to close a loophole regarding spousal rape. Bill sponsors say that the changes are needed because improved DNA testing means that rape survivors increasingly are more likely to come forward. Current state law gives survivors 25 years to report a sexual assault and also permits exceptions for spouses in cases of rape, sexual battery, and more. Rachel Lovell is a research assistant professor at the Bagan Center for Violence Prevention Research and Education at Case Western Reserve University. Since 2015, she has led the Cuyahoga County Sexual Assault Kit Research Project in collaboration with the Cuyahoga County Sexual Assault Kit Task Force and the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. Rachel Lovell, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Between 2015 and 2018, Ohio tested less than 14,000 rape kits. It got about 5,000 DNA matches. How much work? I mean, the state says it's cleared up the backlog now. What's next at this point?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, just making sure that the technology is working well and that I'm not just talking into a computer. So what's next is really following up on the testing of all of those rape kits. So testing is an important first step, but it's just the first step. And now it's really about getting resources and training to follow up with investigations and prosecutions.
When I read about it, it sounds like a lot of police, law enforcement agencies are kind of overwhelmed by this now.
Yeah, I think depending on how many kits a law enforcement agency had, the more urban jurisdictions are ones that definitely have a lot more kits to follow up on. And it's a significant burden that the system is going back decades to look at old rape kits. So it definitely needs a lot of resources to be able to do that.
Why was there a backlog in the first place?
There's many reasons why the backlog developed, but primarily, it first began with the technology. DNA testing wasn't really around until the late 1990s, early 2000s. So when many of these kits were being collected, DNA testing wasn't available. And then once it was available, it was so expensive that it prohibited jurisdictions from really testing all their kits. And it became a pattern with the police department as well as with crime labs and others, that they were prioritizing which kits to be tested. And so they got into sort of a pattern or habit of differentiating between which should be tested and which should not be tested. And so they didn't really see, for example, value in testing non-strangers, because they thought, well, we don't really need the DNA test to be able to do that. We already know, who the suspect is. But they couldn't really foresee how useful testing many of these kits would be and what would be the full value in terms of possibly exonerating suspects or confirming suspects or linking sexual assaults across jurisdictions or even over time.
What do rape kits do? I mean, what is a rape kit?
A rape kit is a set of items in a box or some sort of package or envelope. They usually include swabs and other things, baggies, swabs, those sorts of things, that is just for the evidence collecting or for collecting the evidence. So they, sexual assault nurse examiners, will do an extensive forensic exam, collect all that evidence, put all of that evidence in this box or storage place. Most of the time it's a box, and had then hand that over to law enforcement for storage or for testing.
Hmm. And the kind of testing, they're testing lots of different things, not just one thing. So when they talk about these DNA tests, it's tests on all kinds of evidence.
Yeah, primarily they're testing swabs, or they'll start with testing the swabs and the different kinds of swabs. And then some, depending on protocols and different things, they could test other evidence like clothing, hair combings, you know, perhaps other sorts of evidence that was left at the scene of the crime, or it could be collected as part of it.
How long have rape kits, such as we know them, been around?
I think as we know them, it's really around the 80s and 90s, as we think of them now, although back then it was really blood typing because DNA wasn't available, and there were other types of things that they could do, but they really needed a suspect to be able to confirm it. They couldn't just, there wasn't a DNA database, there wasn't DNA, and there wasn't anything to compare it to. You had to have a suspect. And even then it was like blood typing. But there are cases that I've seen in different jurisdictions that, you know, there was some evidence collected from a sexual assault dating back, you know, 70s and 80s, but it isn't really like the kit that we think about today.
And when I was reading about one of the women whose case revealed that she was the victim of a serial rapist, once this backlog was cleared up, she reflected on the experience of being tested for the rape kit and how she said she had to stand on a sheet for hours.
Yeah, I think as the kits have developed, so has the process for collecting the kits and the exams. So I'll just say I'm not a forensic nurse, mm-hmm. But I know kind of what's involved in general terms with the sexual assault exams. And I think so many of the earlier exams, they weren't done by trained people who were trained just specifically to do these types of forensic exams, and they were just done with and by whatever doctor was on call in an emergency room. I think the process has greatly improved. I mean, I think it still is an extensive process, but I know many wonderful, sane nurses, sexual assault nurse examiner, mm-hmm. And they care very much about making the patient as comfortable as possible, and only doing what's comfortable for the patient. And so I think in some cases victims have reported, you know, having really terrible experiences with the exam. But I think most forensic nurses would say that is more the exception rather than the rule,
right?
Currently, that they really try to make the victim, or in this case client, as comfortable as possible.
You know, just besides the humaneness of that, does it affect any of the outcomes? Does if a woman is treated more respectfully, when with more humaneness at that point, does it affect her ability to recall things? Anything to do with the outcome of the case?
So I think there's a growing body of literature to suggest that we have done, you know, we as a society and we as a in the criminal justice system have really done a terrible job of supporting victims in the process. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, the criminal justice system really isn't designed to help the victims. It's designed to get justice for, you know, get justice and to make offenders accountable. And so I think part of the SAC initiative, the sexual assault kit initiative, is really the ability to go back in time and fix what was perhaps not the best practices and learn from those. So it's really about looking to the past to look to the future about what we can do about to improve the process. So the research is pretty strong in this case about that if and when victims are supported and provided support throughout the entire process, outcomes are better across the board. So that means they're more likely to remain in the process, in the criminal justice process. That means they're more likely to have more extensive sane exams. They're more likely to collect evidence that could be used later. So there's lots of many positive outcomes that can come from providing better support for victims in this process. And that includes, I think, having victim advocates embedded in the process, mm-hmm. from the very beginning, from the, you know, if they want, many jurisdictions have victim advocates that come to the hospital when a victim is getting a sane exam to make sure that she or he, but in many cases it's a she, is getting the support that she needed and her rights are being respected and that things are going in the process, and helping her understand, her, him understand what the process is. So I think there's a great deal of support for providing. We need to do a better job to help victims remain in the process.
And there's now, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, the ability to track a rape kit to make sure that it's being processed and something's being done with it. Ability by the survivor to do that.
Yeah. So across the nation, more and more states actually are developing tracking systems for rape kits, just as if you can track a package with Amazon. It's really a similar idea, although in practice it's a little different. But it's really, you know, tracking a barcode essentially in a process and in a portal. So many states across the nation are getting this. And from, I'm not involved in that process now, but I've been reading some of this stuff and involved and collaborate with many of the people who are part of that process. I recently read Rachel DeSell, who's a reporter from The Plain Dealer, had a story in Sunday's paper about this in Ohio, that the Ohio tracking system is progressing along and hopefully should be available soon.
I mean, you know, you think about the comfort you feel when you can track a package. I can't imagine what a difference it makes to somebody to be able to track progress on their case in that way.
Yeah, I think it just provides a sense of accountability for everyone. So systems always do better when there's an accountability built into that system, not just the criminal justice system, but every system. And so it allows for, yes, for victims to know what happened with them. And in fact, what we learned a lot with the backlog is that victims actually thought their kits were tested. Yeah. They assumed they were tested and that nothing came from it. So here you're really giving victims the ability to have control back of the process and be informed when they want to be informed and how they want to be informed. And it keeps the system accountable, all systems accountable across, so that they're not just sitting in closets. They're not sitting on shelves. They're not just, you know, sitting in emails about what the results of the testing would be.
Is there concern with the backlog being cleared up now that obviously they're picking up on serial rapists that they didn't know about before, and you know, calling victims, survivors, sometimes decades later, telling them, you know, letting them know about this? I'm wondering about re-traumatizing them.
I think that was the part of the conversation from the very beginning with both the initiative that I was involved with in the Cuyahoga County, as well mm-hmm. as the National Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, about being very sensitive to the fact that this, that cold cases and going back to victims who, like you said, decades later, who are in very different places in their lives, and what kind of trauma. So for sure, I think it can be very traumatizing and it can be very disruptive, as anyone would imagine. But I think overall, the system, the best way to approach this in a more victim-centered way is to not let the system make decisions for what's best for the victim. And so as a guiding principle of victim-centeredness. So it's really about if you have this information, if you know a name, if you I've heard some really harrowing stories about, you know, victims getting notified and saying, oh, and by the way, here's your rapist's name, and he lives down the street. Just thought you might want to know that. Or, you know, knowing that there's other victims out there, that they don't feel alone as part of that process, and really giving them the power to say, do I want to know this information? Do I not want to know this information? But I've heard victims say many times about the power of just having that person's name is like taking power back from what was done to them. And so I think it can be re-traumatizing, but with support from victim advocates and with social supports in the system, victims, you know, it can be a very positive thing.
My guest is Rachel Lovell. She's a research assistant professor at the Vegan Center for Violence Prevention Research and Education at Case Western University. There's lots more to talk about. Ohio lawmakers are looking to end the statute of limitations for rape. We're going to talk about that with a state senator representing the Western Cuyahoga County and who's one of the primary sponsors of the measure. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at wosu.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio lawmakers are looking to end the statute of limitations for rape. The sponsors of the bill argue that advanced DNA testing gives victims who come forward a better chance of identifying the perpetrator. Still with us is Rachel Lovell. She's a research assistant professor at the Begun Center for Violence Prevention Research and Education at Case Western University. Her research focuses on gender-based violence, particularly sexual assault. And joining us, one of the primary sponsors of the measure, Senator Nikki Antonio of Western Cuyahoga County. Senator Antonio, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
What inspired you to introduce this legislation now?
Well, I have been a proponent of getting rid of the statute of limitations for sexual assault and rape in Ohio for many years. We had an effort a few years ago in the legislature, and what we were able to accomplish was move it from 20 years to 25. We were going for an all-out elimination at the time, but the political will was not there to do it. We decided we would introduce again, and I have to say that with all of the conversation around the horrific events that happened to many of the wrestlers at Ohio State, that helped us be motivated that now was the right time to again talk about the statute of limitations and now how it needs to be removed in the state of Ohio.
Are you encouraged when you hear the Speaker Householder talk about, you know, his support for doing something?
I'm cautiously optimistic because there is a bill that would just narrowly deal with the victims of
right.
that specific incident.
Mm-hmm.
I am not supportive of that because there are thousands and thousands of others, including the majority of which are women, who have been sexually assaulted for many years, whose voices have not been heard, who have not been reflected in. You just talked about the rape kits and
mm-hmm.
how they've sat on shelves. So we want to see a statute of limitations removed for all sexual assault.
Rachel Lovell, so what about rape kits that are analyzed after the statute of limitations? What happens to those?
So in Cuyahoga County, in particular, the Cleveland Police Department are working through right now on a sexual assault kit initiative grant, testing those that are outside of the statute of limitations
mm-hmm.
that they still had on in their evidence rooms. In terms of prosecution, there isn't anything that can be done with those kits. I mean, they can test them. They may be they may have probative value in the sense that they may link to a kit that is within the statute of limitations. I think it gives a full, it has a better sense of how much offending was going on and the full extent of the criminal offending, perhaps in particular sexual offending. But in terms of being able to prosecute them, it's just, it's not possible. I'm not a prosecutor. I think I've been told they might be able to be used in sort of for sentencing and 404Bs, which is kind of prior bad acts. But that's just what I've been told since I don't have a law degree. Mm-hmm. I don't know the full extent to which it can be used, but they can be used. But in terms of those offenders won't be brought to justice in the same sort of way.
Hmm. Senator Antonio, the Office of the Ohio Public Defender, they weren't able to join us today. They have opposed the legislation. They said in a statement to us that eliminating the statutes of limitations for offenses of rape will result in unintended consequences because it'll create a lack of incentive for law enforcement to conduct prompt and thorough investigations immediately. How do you respond to that?
Well, there hasn't been an incentive so far, so I don't understand how removing the statute of limitations could remove an incentive that I don't see even there. We just continue to hear about backlogs and that this isn't a priority, even in my own community. The other thing is, every day that goes by where there are, as was just discussed, people who are committing multiple sexual assaults, multiple rapes, are walking free and not being prosecuted, they're committing crimes, and they're committing crimes against people in our communities, and that's just wrong.
You know, we are lucky enough to have on the line right now former Ohio Attorney General Betty Montgomery, who is also a former county prosecutor from Wood County. Betty Montgomery, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Ann. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I wanted to just comment on a couple things. I didn't hear the beginning of your show, but applaud you that you're having the conversation about this. You know, the DNA labs were brought when I was AG. We started the DNA labs, and there was a huge backlog, as we were able to try to get our handle around it, we started a pilot project in Cleveland and in Toledo to have them take these rape kits out of their evidence log. And it's appalling to see how many were stacked and not tested, but understandable because there was not a DNA lab, and to do it, that was free. So it was very expensive. Mm-hmm. And unless there was a suspect, they generally didn't test them. So I would make one comment to you. You refer to serial rapists, and may I just say, at least in my experience, except for those date rape kind of circumstances,
yeah.
In my experience, if you've got a rapist, they're a serial rapist. It's not just one rape, and that's why the whole program of getting in and getting it done is really critically important.
Betty Montgomery, let me ask you this. You were, as I mentioned, a former county prosecutor from Wood County. What about the assertion by the Office of the Ohio Public Defender that by eliminating the statute of limitations, you create a lack of incentive for law enforcement to conduct prompt and thorough investigations immediately and pursue it?
I don't mean any disrespect to the public defenders, but law enforcement wants to catch the bad guy. There's no disincentive to catch the bad guy. There are priorities, but that is, for me, not an argument that has much weight.
And do you support eliminating the statute of limitations?
I have reservations in this regard. Depending upon if you got rid of it entirely, my concern is that, A, the re-victimization of the victim, if that's an issue you at least need to think about. I think the second most important thing is can you create an expectation when evidence is very old and witnesses' testimony gets foggy. It gets foggy in in days, let alone years. You want a quality. What you don't want to have out there is an expectation that there's no statute of limitations, therefore you must be able to prosecute it if the testimony or the evidence is weak. And so, you know, you're just going to have to work through that legislatively. Generally speaking, if you have a DNA match, that makes it a lot easier, except that if it's an old DNA match, you want to make certain that the quality, the process, the procedure, the storage, all of those things that keep that evidence legitimate evidence is done.
Okay.
And so that age always adds a huge layer of problem when you're prosecuting the case.
Betty Montgomery, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Anna. Thank you so much for the work you do. This is very important stuff you're talking about, and it's your testimony. Your folks that are talking are doing a wonderful job. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. You bet. Thank you. That's Betty Montgomery, former Ohio Attorney General and former state senator, also former prosecuting attorney from Wood County for many years ago. Nikki Antonio, would the legislation that eliminates the statute of limitations, would it grandfather in older cases, or what would be the takeoff point for that?
Well, first of all, I want to say, while I appreciate former Attorney General's comments, I agree with her wholeheartedly that one rape is usually committed by a serial rapist.
Mm-hmm.
I would, the reason why we've introduced the bill is because just like murder, which has no statute of limitations, we have to rely on sometimes memories from a long time ago, but we don't make the distinction for murder. We shouldn't make it for rape. As far as a back retroactive, mm-hmm. that is something that is not spelled out in the legislation right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's much more difficult to do than going forward. And so that's something that, as we have the debate about this bill, I really believe we'll be able to fine tune whether that's even possible or not. But what I can tell you is that today, when the statute of limitations comes due and then they find the person, the perpetrator, after the fact, even prosecutors have voiced their frustration with not being able, as Betty said, to catch the bad guy. And ultimately, that's what we need to do, is have these people be responsible and also have them off the streets so they're not recommitting crimes over and over again.
Rachel Lovell, I wanted to ask you about some work you're doing. You're a primary investigator on a new grant from the National Institute of Justice to use machine learning technology to analyze the narratives of sexual assault police reports for signaling language regarding a victim's credibility. What is that about?
So we, in our work with the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, part of what we're doing is we are reading many, many rape reports, thousands of rape reports. And one of the things that really stood out to us when reading it is that as a human, you can read the narrative, which a lot of really great details are about the crimes, not just sexual assault, but crimes in general, are in the narratives of the police reports. And you, as a human, could read it and see that it appears in some cases that the officers are sort of signaling or sort of making reference, innuendos about the victim's credibility in the case.
Hmm.
Sometimes it's not innuendo. Sometimes it's very blatant. Sometimes, you know, they just say victim is obviously lying. Sometimes the rape reports, it appears as if the officers are sort of confused by the victim's behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this has to do with a lot of lack of training about how the neurobiology of trauma and how trauma affects the brain and how, for example, laughing may seem strange, but if you've been in a traumatic experience, it's a completely normal experience, not just sexual assault, but other kinds mm-hmm. of traumatic experiences, or having no affect, having no emotion, not crying, not being really visibly upset. So you could see some of that where officers are sort of trying to make sense of this. And then you can see some that are writing the narratives very much as if the media does and other folks, about as if it's consensual, as if the acts are consensual sex. So we are in that grant trying to teach the computer to see if it can pick up innuendo. So we already know and have picked out ones where, as humans, we think there might be instances of signaling. And then we are now trying to see if we can teach the computer to do that. If we can, I think there's some significant implications because, again, those narratives are very important record of crimes. And if we can learn and use research to say that this is perhaps a better way to write this, then that has implications across the board for sexual assault in particular, but other types of crimes as well, to really have better records. And we also know that the way that it can also impact how police officers will think about the crime as well, because we know if you know how you're writing it is also tends to be how you're thinking about it as well.
Senator Antonio, I'm wondering, I mean, there's so many advances in things like this, from DNA testing and everything. And it I guess that's part of the argument of why is there a statute of limitations when we know so much more about how we investigate, how we view, and how we study the evidence?
Absolutely. And I think I would make the argument that because of today's technology, and because of the attention that has really been pressed upon with regard to rape kits, that this bill could actually do just the opposite of what's been said earlier, in terms of, I think the incentive could be higher to process and really find the people responsible and vindicate the victims. Absolutely, the technology today helps us so much more.
And being able to go back and review things like Rachel Lovell was just talking about how they were conducting the investigation in the first place and how they were making assumptions and generalizations about the victims. You know, 20 years ago, we have a whole new perspective on what was going on with them.
Absolutely. And that's in the case where the victim actually reported 20 years ago. But we also, I think, have to have in mind the victim who has suppressed those memories. But then through, whether it's a story about another assault or whatever, their memories get triggered. And suddenly, 20 years later, they're remembering what happened to them. I think the technology would also be there to help them as well as they sort through all of this.
Well, Senator Antonio, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Ann. This is very important, and appreciate your attention to it as well.
That's Senator Nikki Antonio of Cuyahoga County. She is a chief sponsor of legislation that would eliminate the statute of limitations for rape in Ohio. The current statute of limitations is 25 years from the date of offense. Rachel Lovell, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Lovell is a research assistant professor at the Begun Center for Violence Prevention Research and Education at Case Western University. She is since 2015, has led the Cuyahoga County Sexual Assault Kit Research Project. We will be back to continue the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. There's proposed legislation that would eliminate the statute of limitations for rape in Ohio. The current statute of limitations is 25 years from the date of the offense. Lawmakers have put forward the legislation, arguing that advanced DNA testing offers more opportunities for victims to come forward and possibly prosecute the rapists. Emily Gamar is the campus advocacy coordinator with the Sexual Assault Response Network of Ohio. She works with sexual assault survivors, and she joins us. Welcome.
Thank you, Ann.
One of the enduring questions when it comes to this issue is why people wait in the first place. Now, Senator Antonio, Nikki Antonio, one of the sponsors of the legislation I just talked about, said that a lot of times it's a trauma issue that they kind of forget or they block the memory. How does that happen? What do we know about why that happens?
I think that happens because of the way our brain processes trauma and the way it sometimes shuts down when we're presented with a trauma or a fear. Part of our brain may shut off it's a protective measure in order to protect us in that moment. And it may result longer term down the line in fragmented or impacted memories that may take several years to be fully recovered if they are able to be recovered.
And it's a protective thing, so it's a healthy thing.
Yes, absolutely.
But the way the law responds to delays like that, they don't see it that way.
Yeah, it's often met with suspicion or scrutiny, intense scrutiny about why somebody wouldn't be able to remember very specific details in an organized manner when really the brain is shutting down to try and protect itself and kind of conserve whatever it's able to remember.
And then when people don't come forward immediately, there is no rape kit at all. That's not part of the equation at all.
Yeah, there is a time window in order to receive the rape kit. And so if people don't come forward in a timely manner, which is often over a few days immediately following the assault, there isn't an option to recover at least that physical evidence right away.
When someone comes forward to report a rape or sexual assault, what happens? What's the process?
Well, there are several ways that people can report. And typically when we mean report, we're talking about like a formal report with law enforcement. When people get in contact with law enforcement, they are asked to recount details. They may be asked questions to clarify certain instances to try and get a full timeline and picture of what has happened, and then that case is assigned to a detective who will then take the case and do their investigation. So people sometimes call law enforcement. They sometimes go to the police station. A lot of survivors, in our experience at SARNCO, report to emergency departments to get a rape kit or to get medical attention.
They go straight to the hospital.
Yeah, they go straight to the hospital, and law enforcement will be called because of the felony reporting law in Ohio. And so they have the option there at that time to make a report. In Franklin County, we have SARNCO advocates that respond 24/7 to 18 area emergency departments. So an advocate will be there to let them know that that is an option they have and that they are not forced or obligated to make a report at that time.
The felony reporting law in Ohio, who all is affected by that?
All citizens.
Well, so in other words, if you see or know of a felony, you
I know a lot of people aren't aware of that.
People think maybe it's the priest or a psychologist or a teacher or something like that, but anybody.
There are people who are exempted from it, and it's usually people who have some type of privilege. Like
a priest.
Advocates are exempted from the felony reporting law in Ohio.
What difference does it make to have an advocate there? How does that work? What do you offer a victim when they're experiencing the reporting of a rape?
I think it's important to have advocates there, whether it's happening in a hospital or whether it's happening at a police station or happening in a community center where an advocate may be working out of. And that's because law enforcement has a very important job to do, but they have a very specific set of things that they need to try and do in order to do their job correctly.
And advocating isn't one of them.
Advocating isn't one of them. Being emotionally supportive isn't one of them. But if an advocate is there, they are able to be there to support the survivor without an agenda, per se. An agenda often has negative connotations, but in this space, it just means we don't have boxes to check. Our only box to check is to be there for that individual in whatever they want.
And when a law enforcement officer, even if they check the box of empathy, that can affect the outcome of the investigation.
Potentially.
But law enforcement unit agencies are becoming more sensitive to the process, are they not?
I've seen, some agencies in different jurisdictions
they
I work in.
They have their own in-house advocates and that kind of a thing?
Yeah, they may have in-house advocates. They may, voluntarily be going and signing up for training on to be trauma-informed and receive other types of training on. They may have specific sexual assault units that receive more training specifically to work with victims who have experienced this type of violence.
When I was talking to Rachel Lovell out of Cleveland earlier, I mentioned a case that I read about where a woman said that she had to stand for hours on top of a white sheet while they use the swabs to get the evidence. And I'm wondering, what's it like now to experience the rape kit process?
Yeah, I haven't heard of anybody needing to stand on a white sheet in my work with Sarnco. I haven't heard that recently, but I do know that people report to the emergency department. They disclose to whoever's there that they come into contact with first, so whether that's a charge nurse or somebody else, and they try to arrange a social worker to start getting all of the people that need to be there. So I think Rachel mentioned a sexual assault nurse examiner.
Yeah.
We call them SANEs.
Right.
A SANE will be called, an advocate will be called to respond, as will law enforcement. So all of these people are kind of arriving at the hospital. The SANEs have a very particular job to do. Not only are they doing a very specialized medical exam, a forensic exam, they are also keeping the chain of custody intact. There are only certain people who can be handling the evidence. So that's a very specific process that they have to abide by. And they also need to be taking down the narrative, which is something that they are trained to do.
Meaning the interview with the victim.
Yeah. So they're taking it down. And that could be used in court later. So it's a very specific process, just as law enforcement do, to take down the narrative. All while they're doing the exam. So as you can imagine, the SANEs are doing a lot of work.
Yeah, a lot
to
of
take
multitasking.
All of that down, yeah.
And then when the examination or the collection of evidence is occurring, is there more than one person in the room at that time?
I think,
or does that depend on the
I think it
patient?
Depends on the patient and what they'd prefer. Sometimes patients are fine with having an advocate in the room. Sometimes they would prefer not to have an advocate. Even though advocates are there to support, we are still strangers, essentially, kind of intruding on potentially the worst moment in someone's life. And so we make ourselves available. And if somebody would like to have us there to support and provide options and resources, we're there to be in the room with them. Sometimes people bring somebody with them to the emergency department,
a friend or
a family member. And that could be the person that they want to sit beside them and hold their hand.
What is your sense, or is there any kind of guiding knowledge yet about the likelihood that someone will report these days?
I know that there are figures that I've heard either from the FBI or the Department of Justice or even our statewide coalition, the Ohio Alliance to End Sexual Violence, that have reported that I think a third or less than a third of people are reporting. And I believe that's pretty recent, between 2010 and 2016.
A third or less than a third of all the
projected sexual assault victims are actually coming forward and reporting to an official source. So that's obviously quite a low number. Since I've engaged with this work, I've always heard that this is one of the most underreported crimes, if not the most underreported crime.
Have you noticed, or is there anything to talk about when it comes to the fact that whether it's a known assailant, known rapist, or whether it's an unknown, does that change the dynamic?
I can't really speak to that exactly. I do know that when it is a known assailant, there are additional barriers because that could be potentially somebody that you have a relationship with, an intimate partner or a family member. You could love that person. You could have complicated relationship or family dynamics with them. There could be more at stake for you. Mm-hmm. You could have children with them. There could be more stakes at risk to come forward and report the violence.
Another thing that the legislation would do would eliminate an exemption for spousal rape. What do we know about the incidence of that or why there was an exception in the first place?
I know that spousal rape does occur. Mm-hmm. You are more likely to experience sexual violence by somebody that you know than somebody you don't know. I think that this is unfortunately one of the holdouts from when women were considered to be property of their families and spouses. It's something
it
that
was
we
their right.
Yeah, it's their right to do what they please with their spouse. I think that's unfortunately something that we've inherited in this current law that still exists.
When you're advocating for somebody, what has been your experience in the kind of questions they ask about the process and what they don't understand or what they want to know more about?
Mm-hmm. I know people are always concerned about what will be done with their information. It's a very real fear to know that you're potentially signing yourself up for not only a very invasive and re-traumatizing process, but a process that can become quite public. Your information can become public. The media can discover your information, sometimes publish it without your consent, without the survivor's consent.
Although the media tends to avoid that.
It tends to avoid it, but it could happen.
Right.
So sometimes people can be very concerned about their information, especially they may be trying to stay away from their perpetrator and stay unknown. Putting down an address and engaging in this process with them may make them known to their perpetrator. A lot of people are concerned about the timing of the process and just transparency over what steps will happen when, trying to find certainty in a very uncertain process. I would say there are a lot of questions around that. You know, what will happen if I do this? What will happen if they say this? So a lot of trying to ask questions about how the process will go. And what to expect.
Yeah. I know that it's true that most victims of rape are female, but increasingly we're coming to understand that there are lots of victims of rape mm-hmm. who are not.
Yes.
And I'm wondering about how your organization responds to men and boys who have been raped and what kind of services are out there for them.
Yeah, that's a great question. We respond to all survivors of sexual violence, regardless of their gender identity or their gender expression. All of our services are available to folks who need them, who want them.
Is there a different sort of approach with men and boys?
We certainly train all of our advocates to recognize that men and boys may be dealing with different issues
yeah.
than women and girls just because of the societal messages that we place and the expectations that we place on men and boys. Toxic masculinity, things like that, those are all aspects of what our advocates receive training on to better know how to respond to particular concerns that men and boys may have, help dispel some rape culture myths that are directed at men and boys in our work with them, and then connect them potentially to resources in the area that are dedicated to men and boys.
You know, obviously, there's a lot of talk now about the Richard Strauss case at Ohio State. The former team doctor, who's now deceased, apparently took his own life some years ago. Have you noticed an increase, or is that triggered? That kind of is a loaded term nowadays, but more reporting, more conversations about this.
I've definitely noticed more conversations about that case and the need for accountability and justice, even after the fact. I've definitely noticed more conversations about that, and I've noticed more people paying attention to their rights and options in reporting. I think it's one of those things that is starting to kind of lead another mini cultural shift here, especially in Columbus.
Emily Gamarr, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Emily Gamarr is the Campus Advocacy Coordinator with the Sexual Assault Response Network of Ohio. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.